I am a student.
Remember this? It's the sound of protesters at MU back in 2015 telling a journalist that he didn't have the right to take their picture.
Don't push me.
Yo.
I'm not pushing you.
You need to go.
Yep.
Students, can you tell him how
you
much
don't have a right to take our photos?
That was just the beginning of a series of incidents on campuses nationwide. Over freedom of speech, from pressure to cancel controversial speakers, to debates about whether universities should be protecting students from hurtful comments and behaviors. So it's fitting that MU is hosting a national symposium about free speech on college campuses. I'm Gina Kaufman, and one of the organizers of that symposium is MU Law Professor Christina Wells. She's with me now. Hi, Christina.
Hello.
Welcome to Central Standard. So the goal of this symposium is actually to help universities prepare for conflicts over freedom of speech, which is interesting in that maybe there's nothing surprising at this point about those conflicts.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Speech often is a reflection of the conflicts that we're having with one another. That speech doesn't occur in a vacuum. It's a reflection of the thoughts that we're having and of the underlying conflicts that occur.
There's always been tension around this stuff at universities, but it really seems to be coming to a head. Can you kind of give like the short answer to why that may be?
Well, I'm not entirely sure that I can. I'm not sure there is a short answer to that question. A lot of it has to do with universities reflecting bigger issues in society, with university students perhaps being more likely or more willing to speak out on issues. So I think there's probably a plethora of answers out there, and I can only give you a few that seem obvious to me.
Yeah, there are a few different kinds of conflicts we've been seeing in headlines lately. First, I mean, we're seeing a clash between the need for safe spaces that a lot of minority students in particular have been speaking out for and the value of honest discourse, even when it's ugly.
Yes.
Can you talk to me about that sort of category of conflict?
Well, I'm not entirely sure what you want to know there. So there is criticism of students for asking for safe spaces, and there tends to be criticism that suggests that the students are thin-skinned and do not want to hear offensive speech. I think that to some extent that criticism is misguided, partly and in large part because we don't understand what the term safe space means. And we're not giving students enough credit for speaking out or listening to what it is that they're having to say. On the other hand, students themselves are also using very broad terms there, and they are asking for safe spaces in ways that aren't clear and perhaps are overbroad. So there's probably criticism to go around there, and that's one of the reasons why the conflict has erupted. We're not necessarily really listening to each other. In some ways.
Yeah. Can you give an example of I mean, there have been so many, but just pick one that you find especially compelling.
An example of what?
Of that conflict between the students needing safe spaces and or a perceived conflict anyway. I mean, maybe these things really can be reconciled more easily than people think. But yeah, just an example of that particular form of tension.
Well, I think the example that probably most comes to mind in a lot of ways is the a conflict that occurred at Yale, where the students were sent an email by Yale University asking for them to be cognizant of the way that they used their Halloween costumes. A professor then responded with an email saying, perhaps we're overthinking this and students should be allowed to be more offensive. At least that's the way, you know, we used to think about this, that college, was a place where you could sort of be transgressive and sort of work out those offensive actions. A number of students, especially black students at Yale, Responded to that email very angrily. And there was a lot more in that email. I'm having to sort of paraphrase it.
Yeah.
And said, you know, comparing us to kindergarten and preschool students, which is in fact what had happened, is not an appropriate thing to do. There's a lot more than simple offensiveness happening here. And things really spiraled from there. The students and the professor's spouse then really had very ugly interactions, and there were calls for them to resign because they didn't understand that as the heads of the house that the students lived in, they were supposed to be creating a safe space, and this became a big issue in the press.
Can I jump in and say we have some audio of that confrontation that you were just describing. What you hear in this clip is the students sort of surrounding Nicholas Christakis. He's the spouse of the woman who sent the initial email. And the email, of course, in response to the suggestion that people going to a Halloween party in a freshman dorm be sensitive in their choice of costume. And her reply all didn't go over well. Let's listen to what the students had to say to Nicholas and what he had to say back to them.
For all standing students. You understand that? As your position as master, it is your job to create a place of comfort and home for the students that live in Silliman. You have not done that. By sending out that email, that goes against your position as master. Do you understand that?
Then no, I stop. Don't agree with that.
Then why the f*** did you accept the position?
I have a different vision.
You should step down. If that is what you think about being a master, you should step down. It is not about creating an intellectual space. It is not. Do you understand that? It's about creating a home here.
Now, I should say that that's video taken by a guest speaker who witnessed all of this and actually became part of the controversy just a day later. He's the CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, so not a neutral party, and this video was on the Washington Post website. But what do you hear in this, Christina?
I hear two parties being relatively contentious with one another, but in very different ways. I mean, I'm very familiar with that video. I've actually written about it in an article. Video is not something that is new to me. There's no question but that the student there is extremely upset. She's yelling. She's telling him to shut up. She's trying to get him to see her point of view. And from a conflict theory perspective, that's an incredibly contentious tactic. Right? She is trying to overcome his argument with her will, right? Trying to make him see her point of view. He is actually responding much more calmly, but he's also not giving in, right? He is arguing with her as well. So he is also being contentious. He's just being much more what we would say civil about it, right? So that neither of them is going to give ground on this argument. And I think that's the issue there. The students were roundly condemned for their behavior because they were so uncivil and so emotional. And I think that is what strikes me in a lot of our discussions of this, is that so many people condemn the students and so many of these controversies because they're so upset and because they're so angry. And they tend to say that shouting at, being upset, telling people that they shouldn't be allowed to speak is somehow a violation of the speaker's free speech rights. But that's not really how the First Amendment works, right? The First Amendment applies to government officials who try to censor others, not private individuals who are interacting with each other. We're allowed to be uncivil and rude and say disgusting things to one another. That's what the protection of offensive speech is. That doesn't mean that it's the right way to approach a conflict or the right way to serve your own interests. It really depends on what your interests are.
Is having conflicts like this an important part of the education experience? I mean, what I actually feel when I hear her is it reminds me of my own attempts to express my opinion and my point of view at that age. I mean, you kind of have to work through that experience when you're new to it.
Well, I think that it's certainly if you learn something from it. I mean, if it may be part of the expressive nature, they may needed to express themselves and to try to see how that worked out. They may take away something from that. So, yeah, all of it's a learning experience, certainly. And again, from a conflict perspective, whether they further their goals, whether they what they're trying to achieve, what their underlying interests are, all of those things are important in examining what it, you know, whether or not they sort of achieve their agenda, whether you know whether or not they successfully bring people over to their side. You know, they may have achieved their agenda in getting the Christakis to resign. They also may have set back their agenda in terms of race relations and in terms of getting people to be sympathetic because of their contentious tactics. So there are a lot of different factors going on there, but certainly it's a learning experience.
Can you also talk to me about the difference between having a right to say something offensive and having a right to say it without repercussions?
Right. So when we talk about the First Amendment right, that right exists insofar as your rights against government officials, censorship. So if you read our Constitution is a constitution of rights against government action, right?
Right.
It doesn't apply to private individuals and their actions for the most part. I mean, there are a few nuances there, but the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. And that has been interpreted as Congress and state and local officials as well. So your rights are the right to be free of censorship from government officials. Right? So that's the literal right.
Right. You can't be put in jail.
Right. Or you can't be punished with fines or – and that has also been interpreted to be free of court orders telling you not to say things.
But that doesn't mean you can't be kicked out of school.
Well, it does mean that you can be kicked out of school. Actually, if it's a public school and the disciplinary rules – are based on – or they're one-sided, saying, you know, only certain kinds of protesters can be kicked out. So they're, so school officials are considered to be government officials if they're public school officials, right? So MU has got rules that apply to it as a public school that Yale actually doesn't have that apply to it because it's a private school, right? But there are certain ways in which private individuals – are subject to some of these rules if they engage in disruptive speech. For example, a speech that physically disrupts, so hecklers, when they go into – like at Middlebury College, for example, hecklers can be arrested for shutting a speaker down, but they aren't arrested under speech laws. They're arrested under breach of the peace laws. So they're erected for what basically speech that has become conduct-like.
So this brings up the other kind of category of flare-up we've been seeing, which is around guest speakers on campus and especially speakers who are seen as emboldening hate groups.
Yes.
Talk to me about those.
Well, so this is an area where I think several different things are happening, right? So there are speakers who come to campus and, for example, what happened at Middlebury I'm sorry, I'm going to forget the name of the author. It's the author of the Bell Curve who came and the students and faculty spoke out initially and said, we don't want him to come. And they were very vocal about that. That in and of itself is not a problem. That is just – even though people think of it as intolerant, it's simply the faculty and the students expressing counter speech and counter positions. But when he did come, students and faculty stood up. They held signs. Again, not a problem. Counter speech that isn't terribly disruptive. But then heckling started, and it got to the point where he was unable to continue his speech. And when you have a speaker who has been invited, that becomes more problematic. And the Supreme Court's First Amendment cases make pretty clear that when you have a speaker who is legitimately there, the government officials, especially the police usually in cases like that or security officials, have an obligation to protect the speaker's rights and that it is their obligation to sort of make sure that the hecklers are escorted out or arrested or whatever needs to be done so that you don't give rise to a heckler's veto of the speaker. So that's what I've been seeing, and I think what a lot of us have been seeing in the First Amendment field is sort of very broad criticism of students and faculty and people in the community. In fact, in the Middlebury community itself, many people were unhappy about the invitation to the speaker. Simply, there was condemnation of those counter-protesters simply for voicing their opinion that he shouldn't be allowed to speak. That, I think, is sort of wrong-headed. But condemnation of violence or massive disruption of speakers is pretty consistent with the court's position in First Amendment cases. Now, I do think that the situation with hate speech is really, really complicated, because hate speech, especially racially based hate speech, gender or identity based hate speech, really goes to the core of a person's identity
and safety.
And absolutely. And so you're talking about speech, the very nature and content of which could not be more contentious. So again, no matter how nicely it's said, no matter how academic the presentation, you are telling people, we do not think that you deserve to be treated with dignity or respect. So there's almost no way that you can convince counter-protesters that they should listen to that. Why should they be asked to listen to that or to, you know, respond to it with civility? And that's why,
well, especially this is their home. I mean, they often live on campus.
Oh, yes. And I think that's actually something that a lot of people forget, is that campuses are very complicated places. We talk about free speech on campus, but something that maybe should be allowed to be said on we have this place called Speaker Circle at Mizzou. It's a very large open space. Something that maybe you can say at Speaker Circle maybe shouldn't be allowed in someone's dorm, because that's their safe space. And again, the Supreme Court recognizes that a person's home is their castle, and they have very strong privacy interests in that, to be free from offensive speech. So yeah. There, I think that's something that people sometimes don't recognize, is that we need to consider what a university is and how complicated it is. I know that our keynote speaker, Robert Post, who is the Sterling Professor of Law at Yale and used to be the dean at Yale, is one of the really most thoughtful and influential speakers in the First Amendment area, is going to talk about the nature of the university and what it means to have different rules.
Well, I'd love to hear from students out there, whether your experience is current or from decades past. Has someone else's exercise of speech been harmful to you in the university setting? Or did you benefit from an encounter with offensive comments and ideas? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, talking with MU Law Professor Christina Wells. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about the tension, or at least perceived tension, on college campuses between free speech and safe spaces. Are these things really in conflict? And if so, what takes precedence? We'd love to hear your experiences at 816-235-2888. And my guest is Christina Wells. She's a law professor at MU who's organizing a symposium on this, which is tomorrow. Christina, you specialize in this issue of speech and freedom of speech on college campuses. What got you interested in the issue?
Well, I was lucky enough when I was getting my law degree at the University of Chicago to study under two really well-known free speech experts, Jeff Stone and David Strauss. So I partly just had really, really good mentors. But I had come to Chicago from the University of Kansas, where I was a student leader. And
wait, what does that mean?
I was the president of all of the sororities. I was on a leadership council. And while we were there, there was a movement by another student leader, actually, who I truthfully don't remember who it was. I just remember it was another one of my colleagues, to have the fees that went to, you know, student groups that are parsed out to student groups from our student fees that we pay as students, to have them taken away from the Gay and Lesbian Services of Kansas. And the ostensible reason for that was that they were self-funding. But many of the groups at the University of Kansas had fees that came in from other areas. So there was a strong perception that it was based on prejudice. And that was really offensive to me. I didn't understand why people would do that. It struck me as mean-spirited.
So did it seem like, I mean, in a way, like funding was a tool for silencing a group?
Yes, because subsidies are often very important to student groups. Student fees help fund a lot of different things. So when I was at the University of Chicago and on the Law Review, there was an opportunity to write my student comment on the use of student fees for student groups and whether or not you could deny them based on the content of the student group's speech. So that is how I got interested in the First Amendment.
But what was the argument? I mean, it was on the surface, the argument was strictly that, well, that group has funding from other sources, so they don't need it.
Yes, that was the argument ostensibly, but it didn't make sense because many other groups also had external funding and nobody was trying to take their funding away. And our chancellor at the time was Gene Budig, and this was my junior year when I had started to be a leader, and I came back my senior year in the fall, and we had a fall convocation, and Chancellor Budig made a very strong point in his convocation speech to say, we don't vote student groups off campus because we don't like them, and it was one of the best speeches I'd ever heard. So I was very excited when I got to law school and there was an opportunity to write a comment on this topic.
Do you worry that, that subtleties like the one you're describing are getting lost in today's climate where it's such kind of big ideas rather maybe more than nuance?
Truthfully, the subtleties with the First Amendment have always gotten lost. It's a very, very complicated area of the law, and I think people tend to say, I'm for the First Amendment and not PC, and they don't really understand. And that's probably a failing on our part not to really teach the First Amendment in a much more nuanced way. It's always an issue with the Constitution that it's not nearly as black and white as people think that it is. And my experience when I go out and I do talk to different groups in the community when I'm invited to go talk to Learning and Retirement or when I went to the Dole Institute to talk about the issues that arise surrounding the Westboro Baptist Church when they were protesting, that people are quite receptive to arguments when you talk to them about the nuances. They're very willing and eager to learn about them, but you just have to have an opportunity to do that.
The accusation that gets leveled at students a lot right now is just that this generation, you know, gets referred to as snowflakes a lot. You know, like this idea that they're too fragile to handle conflict or dispute, that they've been treated as special. And something that has always kind of, I don't know, that I've always wondered about that argument. It's just this is also a generation that's grown up with dealing with school shootings, dealing with issues of, just a kind of conflict and, threat out in the world that maybe previous generations didn't. And I wonder what you think is particular to this generation and what has always been true about these issues on college campuses.
Well, I do think this generation is different. And I think the issue of and I have a daughter who's 14, so she's a little bit younger than the students on college campuses. But it's certainly different than when I grew up. The idea of going to a school and having to worry about somebody coming with a gun and shooting, you know, numerous people is just simply not something that even occurred to me anywhere through elementary school or college. So having to live with that reality, I think, is something that most people in my generation, and I'm in my 50s, just simply doesn't – we don't understand. I mean, it's just not something we ever had to deal with. So that is a difference. But I do think that students in this generation do think differently about diversity and inclusion. I think it's something that they're taught. I think they're taught a lot about bullying. And that, again, is not something that we were raised with in the same way. And so they do approach issues differently. I teach this generation. I don't view them as having anything in terms of they're not deficient in critical thinking skills. They are able to articulate arguments quite well. I think the point is they have different arguments that they want to make. They may be questioning our approach to hate speech. It's fine to question the Supreme Court's approach to hate speech. The Supreme Court may not change it, and we may have to say, these are the rules that we live with. And there are reasons why the Supreme Court has ruled the way that it has, and they're not bad ones. But for them to question those rules doesn't make them snowflakes. It just makes them a group of people that has a different lens through which they view things.
Let's talk to Patricia in Kansas City. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, how are you?
Good.
What would you like to share?
Well, I'd like to share the fact that I am a former college administrator, and I do understand academic freedom as it applies to the classroom. I don't know where this notion of unfettered free speech comes from, though. I have to tell you that when I was in college, which was a while ago, for my bachelor's, we Vietnam protesters, if we weren't shot, then we faced a line of police with clubs, or at the very best, we had to get permission to march through the streets. I know there's a tradition of academic discourse that has been stronger in the past than it is today. But I don't know. Speak to me. I mean, I don't know why we think it's okay to just say anything on a college campus. And I don't think that that does abide by most colleges' rules, and I don't think it leads to a happy campus life.
Okay, Christina, what do you have to say to Patricia?
I guess I'm not entirely sure that what's happening is people saying anything that they want. I mean, incivility is just something that's protected by the First Amendment. Incivility, if it were to be punished simply for being uncivil, for example, out on Speaker's Circle, would absolutely violate the rules that the court has set up. Being shot for being a protester is probably not okay. Everyone sort of views that as a tragedy, I think. You do have – there are regulations, time, place, and manner regulations and permit requirements for protesters. And for the most part, most universities try to use those to manage protests so that we don't have riots. So I don't think that it's a free-for-all. I guess I'm not entirely sure where that description's coming from.
You know, something I think is interesting about this too is that – is there a difference between – What people should and shouldn't be able to say in a classroom during a class discussion, or what is and isn't intellectually beneficial to have expressed in a classroom during a class discussion, and then these issues of things that happen elsewhere on campus. And
no, classroom discussion is an entirely different issue, right? So those are issues that professors and students alike do, I think, need to abide by the need to have academic and pedagogical principles guide what it is that they say. And if you were to harass or say things that interfered with the learning environment, then I think you can be punished. And those, I think most people would accept that.
Let's talk to Joe in Overland Park. Hi, Joe.
Hello. I was listening to the tape that you played with the one girl who was shouting, and I was curious to hear if you've ever talked to people like that and whether they think that safe spaces apply just to their opinion, or if they have a fellow dorm mate who has a different opinion, how that's resolved. Is it a freedom to express themselves, or is it a freedom not to have to deal with differing opinions? And also, where's, when you're talking about hecklers and counter-protesters, where's like the litmus or dividing line between somebody having their free speech versus turning into censorship, depriving somebody else of their free speech rights?
Okay, Christina.
Well, I think we haven't really adequately, and I don't think anybody's really thought carefully a lot lately about what the meaning of safe space is. In that particular encounter, I think from having read through the materials and looked at the tapes, the students were trying to tell the professor who was the head of the house that they lived in that the two professors who happened to be married, it was their obligation to create a safe space for all of the students who lived there.
Right, and that's different than safe to express your opinion.
Right, that the students should feel that the professors had their backs. Beyond that, I think there is a need to talk about what we mean by safe space, and people do need to come to grips with that. And there is discussion in academic circles about how that term is bandied about, and I think people on both sides of the political spectrum honestly use that in ways that we haven't quite figured out what is meant. And I'm sorry, I've forgotten what the second part of the question was.
I think that when the idea of when trying to when trying to create safety for one group, you censor another, perhaps. And I think that might be in some ways the same question.
Right. So when it comes to protesters and counter-protesters, and that's what I heard, at least in that question, now that you've sparked my memory. And so I don't know if I'm answering it quite exactly the question that was asked. Certainly, if you shout down other if you shout down speakers or you shout down other protesters, that I think is amounts to this heckler's veto that I was talking about, where you're not letting the speakers actually get out their message to an audience that wants to hear it. That would be a problem, and that would amount to something akin to censorship that the court has alluded to. But the fact that you are heckling or that you are shouting or that two people are having an argument and they're shouting at one another, just private citizens, that's just two people having an argument, right? And so that's something I think you have to sort of make the distinction of. We're allowed to be offensive and uncivil to one another. And we're allowed to even heckle one another from the audience as long as the other sort of designated speaker, the officially sort of sponsored speaker, is allowed to get their message out.
You know, speaking of terminology, safe spaces, like that is a word that is being sort of worked out and processed really publicly right now. The buzzword when I was in college was tolerance. And that is a word I'm sort of fascinated that we don't really hear much anymore. We hear inclusion, we hear other buzzwords. But I remember a professor one day in a class asking how we felt about the idea of tolerance. And one student, a student of color, expressed that she thought tolerating each other and each other's opinions was not good enough. She thought we should be doing more to even perhaps understand each other, which is beyond just tolerating or maybe even celebrate. And another student really objected, saying there were lots of ideas he was never, ever going to celebrate. And his position was that tolerance, if it's genuine, is a really high bar. I wonder if there's a version of that debate going on today, just in different words.
Well, and I think that's part of what's happening, again, with these encounters between private citizens. I mean, the government is required to tolerate all sorts of speech. It's not allowed to regulate speech based on its content unless it falls into one of these sort of speech as conduct categories, like threats or something that causes an immediate danger. But once we're outside of the arena of government regulation, it's really created this wide open area of public discourse where we are sort of responsible for how we engage one another. And the issue of tolerance becomes, I think, much more difficult. We want people to engage with many different ideas. And maybe that's the word that is becoming more, I think, the issue. How do we engage with each other? Should we shout at each other? Should we listen? Should we have actual dialogue? Which is a very different question from should we debate one another? Again, debate is a more contentious tactic. Dialogue is where we sit and listen to one another and try to solve our problems. And I think those are the questions that we're starting to answer or ask and find answers to. So I think the debate may be taking somewhat different terms now, because I'm not sure people know what it means to tolerate. And the hate speech issue has really brought that up. I think there's a huge number of people that are like, why should we have to tolerate this? It doesn't mean that you can't say it, but I don't have to respond positively to what you say.
You know, you've talked some about the misunderstandings that exist just in the general public about what the First Amendment does and doesn't cover, what freedom of speech really means, what safe spaces mean, and that there are things that people could be better informed about. But what are the questions that you think people who are pretty informed on this, like yourself, what questions do you have? What do you still not quite know how to understand?
I think one of the reasons why I really became interested in dispute resolution and conflict theory was this, because you realize that there is this huge area of unregulated speech that the First Amendment and the Supreme Court's jurisprudence contemplates, this area that we call public discourse, that really leaves it on us as the polity to engage in. And so it's on us. It's our moral obligation to figure out a lot of issues about democratic governance. And that's one of the things the First Amendment is really all about. It imposes rules on government officials about what to do. But beyond that, we are the decision makers, and we've got to figure out how to talk to one another and how to engage one another. And I'm not sure how to do that.
Well, I think a lot of us are not, but Christina Wells, I really hope the symposium goes well, and you'll have to let us know what comes of it, okay?
Okay, thank you.
The Symposium on Free Speech on Campuses takes place at MU this Friday. Up next, one of our regular guests tells the story of the year his dad lost his job and remembers the KCK social worker who changed their lives. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and Daniel Cerda joins us now. He's a regular guest on this show, but he usually joins us to talk as a city planner, to discuss infrastructure, design, ideas. Today, he's going to share his own story, set in Wyandotte County, where he was raised by immigrants in the 1960s. We're zooming in on one year in particular. Daniel, good morning.
Good morning.
The year was 1966.
I wasn't here yet.
What?
I wasn't here yet. Something really important happened a few years before I was born, and that was my father lost his job. It was a job that had brought my entire family to Wyandotte County, actually the central Wyandotte County, the rural part of Wyandotte County, the area near K-32 Highway and 435 today, which is a lot of warehouses and distribution facilities, but back then was primarily a lot of small family-owned farms.
And it brought your parents to that area from...
From actually Oklahoma, but my family was, both of my parents, should start by saying both of my parents were Mexican nationals. All of my siblings were born in the United States. And the primary explanation for that was that my father was 20 plus years older than my mother and was actually born in 1910, the year that the Mexican Revolution started. And so my father was raised by extended family on the Texas side of the U.S.-Mexican border. In the Rio Grande Valley, not too far away from Corpus Christi, a little town called Donna, Texas. And if you do any searching of my last name, most of the people with my last names, particularly spelled with an S, you will find are in the Rio Grande Valley. We have a lot of extended family there, including some first cousins that I don't know at all because I've never met them. Some of them are older than me, some of them are younger than me. But my family is originally from the Rio Grande Valley, technically the Mexican side, but there is a historical footnote to that, which is that Texas wasn't always Texas. There was a period when Texas was part of Mexico. And so technically my father's extended relatives that he lived with were what were often referred to as Tejanos, who were people who lived, basically people of Mexican descent, who lived in what was Mexico after it became Texas and who had been here since before, obviously, the conquest. So anyway, there's a long history to that. But my father had worked as an agricultural laborer and had started driving a truck back during the Depression and was doing long-haul produce deliveries as far north as Duluth, Minnesota, basically the north-south corridor of what were state and U.S. highways that eventually became I-35. And the family had settled in Oklahoma by the 1950s, and in the mid-1950s, they moved to central Wyandotte County so that my father could take a job managing a ranch in central Wyandotte County. And then in 1966, he lost that job when he was underbid by actually someone he knew and considered a friend. But he lost that job, and my family was thrown into a certain degree of disarray, and they ended up in a little house.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing you fear, right?
Oh, absolutely. I talked to my mother about this not very long ago. She passed away a couple years ago, and it was probably less than 5 years ago we had this conversation. I said, what was that really like? And she said, just sheer terror. We had no idea what was going to happen. And their presumption was, you know, they'd kind of become acclimated. They'd sort of planted roots, so to speak. Although talking to my brothers and sisters, it was less than ideal living circumstances. They were living in trailers on this farm on what used to be a small private airstrip out there. And, you know, really, really marginal conditions. They did not have plumbing, that sort of thing. But they were thrown into just absolute terror in terms of what was going to happen. And what did happen, the short version of the story, is within a few months, they were assisted by some staff from the Wyandotte County Health Department. And that assistance turned into finding a job for my father as a custodian in the Kansas City, Kansas School District, helping my father find a house, a little dinky house, to buy. That was the house where I was born and raised and where my mother lived until her death, and where my entire family considers that house home. It's belonged to our family for over 50 years.
And there's one woman in particular who seems to have made a special impression.
Absolutely. I have recollections when I was a kid. Give you an example. One year toward Christmas, I was probably 7 or 8 years old. There was a woman who I only knew as Mrs. McCurley. And her name is very memorable. One of my sisters, in fact, used to joke about Shirley, Shirley, Mrs. McCurley. She made a little limerick out of her name. But apparently Mrs. McCurley sort of doted over our family. And I remember her just occasionally showing up. And it seemed like she would just come and sort of sit down and talk with my parents. I never knew what they were talking about. But the one memory that very distinct memory I have is one year she brought us presents for Christmas. And I remember, you know, Christmas in our family, like every family is a big deal. And you wait till at least Christmas Eve to open gifts. But my parents said, you can go ahead and open this. I remember she gave me some sort of a truck or something. I was doing some research recently in historical newspapers, and most of what I was looking at was from the 1920s and 1930s. But somehow I stumbled across a reference to her name and found out more about her biography. And the short version of that is that she, back in the 1960s, was one of several staff within the Wyandotte County Health Department who were working under the auspices of a federal grant to aid migrant workers. And it was in that context that she essentially became the social worker who helped my family through that difficulty. And again, to tie up that story neatly and try to make meaning of it, I grew up where I did in that little house in the Armourdale neighborhood in Kansas City, Kansas, basically because of Mrs. McCurley and because of the fact that my father lost a job and because of the fact that my parents were thrown into that incredibly dire uncertainty. And I commented recently that I think the hard reality is if that intervention had not happened, in all likelihood, my family probably would have returned to South Texas, possibly even to Mexico. In either case, I would not have been born in Kansas City, Kansas. I would not have lived most of my life there. And more importantly, every other conversation you and I have ever had probably wouldn't have happened because it was living in those circumstances, growing up in a neighborhood that was rapidly hollowing out and undergoing some really drastic both economic and racial and social change back in the late 60s and early 70s. It was all of that that piqued my curiosity and got me interested in neighborhoods and cities and economics and everything else that I've ever done professionally.
You know, thinking about this moment that strikes just abject terror in the hearts of your parents, this moment mm-hmm. of your dad losing his job as a migrant farm worker, that seems now that you're looking back on it, to be actually a story of what gave you the curiosity and the perspective and just the life situation that made you who you are.
Well, it's a real epiphany to even understand that, because I never knew that. You know, I if you talked to me 20 years ago, I would tell you, and people said, well, you know, why are you so interested in what you're interested in? Because I've been doing what I'm doing now professionally for over 20 years. I would have just said, well, it has to do with growing up in that neighborhood and being very curious about these questions. You know, why is there so much inequality? You know, why are businesses leaving this area and businesses seem to be growing somewhere else? Why are housing conditions so horrible here and they're so much better somewhere else?
But can you explain that a little bit? What was it like to grow up in Armourdale?
Well, the primary thing that strikes me back then was you could see, and you still can. It's not as visible now physically, but there was still not only the physical imprint, but there were still actually sort of a functioning local economy there. There were a lot of small scale, what you are often characterized as mom and pop type businesses. But what was happening is they were incrementally just closing down. One of our favorite spots, I tell my kids about this all the time because it's a magical sort of thing. There was a little store a block from our house that was primarily we thought of as the candy store. It was owned by an elderly woman named Noreen, and that's what it was called. It was called Noreen's. And we would literally scrape up change. We'd go around looking under sofa cushions and that sort of thing, you know, get up together, maybe my brothers and sisters and I, 47 cents or something. And we could walk into Noreen's and with 47 cents, we could buy this penny candy, that penny candy, this for a nickel, that for a dime, and come back with these little brown paper bags full of candy. It was a little dry goods store, probably about, you know, 15 feet wide and 20 feet deep. It was a tiny little hole in the wall kind of place. And it closed down probably when I was 10 years old. But there were a range of other businesses like that where, again, you know, I was born in 1969. My family lived there a few years before. My older sister has told me, you know, there were so many more active businesses right there on the avenue, so to be meaning Osage Avenue, which is a block from our house, back when we first moved in than there were when you were a kid. It was just stunning to watch the neighborhood empty out.
So growing up in that atmosphere had always been the entirety of your understanding of what made you the city planning person that you are.
Yeah.
There's more to it.
Well, the other aspect of that story, though, too, is that the city at the time was contributing to that hollowing out. There was an urban renewal program that had literally removed half of the neighborhood and converted it to industrial use. So that was also heightening that uncertainty. But yeah, that was all that I knew about it. I didn't know very much about the circumstances by which my family landed or arrived in those circumstances, other than that there was this backstory. I did know, however, from my older brothers and sisters, they always told me how lucky I was having grown up there because they grew up on that farm and at other farms and worked on farms in Oklahoma. And basically, you know, as soon as they were old enough, they were out working, harvesting lettuce, asparagus, cabbage, and that sort of thing. And I never had to do that. And again, you never know. If my family had ended up back in South Texas or Oklahoma or whatever the case is, those might well have been the circumstances that I grew up in.
Hester McCurley, as this character whose significance in your life, the social worker who helped your family land where they did, what do you know about her? I mean, about her role in the community more broadly?
Not a lot, but I was very astounded by what I found recently. I think it was around that time that she helped my family. She was given an award by a statewide association as Nurse of the Year in the state of Kansas for some of the kinds of things she'd done. She was working in the public health department, so she was doing things like inoculating kids against polio and that sort of thing, and then happened to be assigned to this migrant program. I passed around that article to some members of my family. One of my older sisters called me and said, she said, you know, I had heard, you know, several years back when she passed away, you know, that she had died. But, you know, she was there. She was always there for so long. And, you know, obviously she eventually left that job and we didn't hear from her. But occasionally we would hear about how, you know, Mrs. McCurley had called and was still staying in touch with her parents. She said as recently as probably 25 years ago, she knew that she had been in touch with my family.
I mean, obviously, you're really touched by what she did to your family and just the discovery that Mrs. McCurley had just to know more of her story and her role in the community. Is there something that you take away from that as just a member of the community yourself as thinking about, I don't know, our responsibilities to one another or?
Well, I haven't said this, but it is an important aspect of the story. She was African-American. And I think there's an interesting reaching across boundaries just in that alone. I think it's very interesting that as a woman, a social work profession and as a health profession, that she reached the level of professional distinction she seemed to. And again, it's obvious in my case, I just have this profound appreciation now for the impact that she had on my life without ever really having known or understood that until very recently.
And probably other people's.
Absolutely.
Our time is up. Daniel Serta, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Yeah. Thank you for having me again.
That is a wrap. You can listen back to this morning's conversations at kcur.org/Central Standard. And I know it's a long shot, but if Hester McCurley changed your family's life like she changed Daniel Serta's, go ahead and tweet us the story. We're at KCURCST. Tomorrow, join us for a food show. We're going to delve into the season's finest pumpkin and pie, but not necessarily together. How to use pumpkin as a savory ingredient in your own kitchen, and a search for the best pies around town. That's tomorrow at 10. Don't miss it. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman, and KCUR's Up to Date is next, so don't miss it.